Animal shelters in New York City are being overwhelmed with pets whose owners can't afford to keep them. As rents rise in Greater Cincinnati, what's happening here? You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A new survey found many couples with two incomes and no kids have made financial sacrifices for their dogs and cats. Today on our pet show, we'll discuss the rising costs of keeping our furry friends healthy and happy. And we have a panel of experts here to answer your questions. Joining me now are University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, MedVet Cincinnati Veterinary Dentist, Dr. Emily Ward, Dog Abilities Owner and Trainer, Dave Groden, and Cincinnati Animal Care Shelter Director, Megan Colville. Welcome back, everybody. It's great to have you here today.
Great to be back.
Thanks.
If you have questions for them, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And a note for our listeners, medical advice offered on our program is general in nature and should not substitute for a visit to your pet's vet. Okay, I think we're all pet owners here. Pet parents, depending on how you define yourselves. Are you spending more to care for your pets these days? What kind of costs have you seen increase? I'll start with you, Dr. Ward.
So, yes, I've spent a lot on my animals this year, mostly because my pets did have some medical needs. One of my dogs was diagnosed with pulmonary carcinoma, so we did a lot of surgery.
Goodness.
She's going through chemotherapy right now, so I'm spending quite a bit of money on my animals at the moment in time.
Hope she's doing okay.
But, I mean, in general, if you look at the cost of especially specialty veterinary care, which is what I do, the costs do tend to go up about 3 to 5% per year. Across the board, it's, you know, for the actual medicines themselves and the drugs that we use, the equipment that we use, and then obviously professional fees and services are incorporated in that too. So yes, everything is continuing to get more expensive.
Yeah. What about you, Dr. Wells?
Yeah, I agree. I've been fortunate that my dog did not have to go to MedVet this year, but my cat has been there twice and my dog's been there once for major medical issues. I think some of us in the veterinary profession are a little bit fortunate that we can somewhat subsidize the cost of some of the easier things. You know, I don't have to go to the vet every time, you know, a toenail comes off or something similar to that. But I do appreciate that many of our, you know, regular general practitioners are having to charge more for their services. And, you know, it's just because of the economy. Things cost more, as Dr. Ward said. And then we do have to pay our staff more to keep up with their rising costs. And so I think that's important to realize. But it should be noted, too, that we are starting to see a little bit more insurance, which will help some owners be able to afford some of those major medical care when needed, or some insurance plans might even pay for regular veterinary care as well. Mm. So we're getting a little bit more into that, which is something new.
Yeah. Day, what about for you? I know you've got more than one dog, right?
Yes, I have four.
Okay. I knew it was more than one. I didn't want to guess on the number.
Yeah, I think for sure. I mean, just basic care of my dog. So things like food, treats, those type of things. I mean, those have all gone up in cost a bit. I do tend to do a lot of activities with my dogs in terms of different types of sports and things like that. And I know compared to like last year, I've definitely kind of cut back just a little bit on that.
All that costs money too, right?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, dog sports in general, I mean, they're not cheap, depending on what you do. So I've definitely kind of watched that a little bit more. Knock on wood, my dogs have been all really pretty healthy, so I haven't had to do, you know, any kind of increased costs with vet care or things like that.
Yeah. What about you, Megan? I'm not sure if I know what your critter situation is at home.
There's quite a few cats and dogs. Okay. But in addition to that, we got goats and chickens as well. So just kind of a whole variety of animals.
Yeah.
And absolutely, I'm in the same boat as everyone else here. I think medical care is typically the highest, even on a good day, before things go wrong. In addition to that, just the daily cost of food, participating in sports, we do that as well with the dogs, get them into even training classes and things like that. So absolutely, we've seen costs go up as well.
Yeah. Well, and feeding those chickens, I hear chicken feed has gotten expensive.
Yeah. The chickens and goats can be pretty pricey as well.
Yeah. Yeah. At least the goats are cutting your grass, right?
Yeah. A little bit.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Megan, do you get lots of calls at the shelter from people who feel like they need to surrender their pets because they just can't afford to take care of them anymore?
Yeah, and I think it can be complicated with why they're asking to surrender. Sometimes it can be a multitude of things, and which one is the most pressing is often the one that we end up kind of noting in our data. But just in the last 3 weeks, we've fielded about 100 calls for surrendering between cats and dogs. Mm. And so we know that's pretty consistent. You know, really since we've, since Animal Care has been running the county shelter in Hamilton County since 2020, owner surrenders are a big part of the requests we get for help. The top two reasons have been a lot of behavior, especially with the dogs. And I think, you know, the cost of getting a trainer, the cost of going to classes can be, you know, a problem for a lot of people. And then secondly, medical and housing as well. Yeah. So the housing piece, I think, is obviously often tied to financial reasons, too.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Do you have a sense for whether other shelters in the region are getting those kinds of calls, too, or experiencing that? You know, calls from people who, I love my animal, but I just can't afford my cat or dog anymore.
Yeah, I don't know specifically with a lot of the other shelters in the region, except I can only imagine. Our data stayed pretty steady. We're the largest county in the region, so we probably get more. But per capita, I bet it's about the same, I would imagine, in a lot of the surrounding communities as well.
Yeah. We're talking about pets for the full hour today. Do you have questions about your cat or dog? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Dr. Ward, I've taken pets to MedVet for emergency care, not lately, and I hope your dog is doing okay.
She's doing great.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. The team there is always really careful to explain the costs, and in my experience, it's been in a very respectful, kind way. But, and I know that's not your job necessarily, but have you noticed whether cost is becoming a bigger deciding factor for people? Whether, like, I love my pet, but I just can't afford this right now?
So I would say yes to that. I think veterinary dentistry in particular is an interesting subset of specialty veterinary care, right? Their pets are not in a life-threatening situation. No one is imminently dying. And although I think that the work that I do has an enormous benefit to my patients, so I tell all my clients, I'm not saving anybody's life, but I'm in the quality of life business.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think like it's hard enough for many people to afford dental care for themselves. And then you're talking about your dog comes in and they were playing in the yard. This is like the large dog problem. They bite a rock or the fence, or they get tangled up in someone else's collar. Now a tooth is broken. And you don't want to extract your dog's tooth because the dog's 3 years old, right? And like it stinks to have to take out this big, beautiful tooth from your German Shepherd. So you want to try and save it. Well, for a root canal procedure where I can go in just like in a human and basically save that tooth, what's left of it, and we put a filling on it and they can keep it for the rest of their lives. Super successful procedure, 95% success rate, like keep the tooth, it's great, okay? But to do that, because it involves anesthesia and then it involves my technical skill and, you know, there's dental x-rays involved and then my staff are incredible people who are very good at their jobs. We have to make sure they can eat and put a roof over their head and all those things, right? You're looking at like somewhere between $3,000 and $4,000 to do that, right? So I think for me, for people who are paying out of pocket, that's becoming more challenging for them because it is expensive, right? And it takes a certain type of owner who it's really important to them to have that particular procedure done. I do a lot of extractions because sometimes root canal is just not achievable. That's okay. You have to do something about it. I'm happy to do whatever is best for that pet. But luckily, I am also seeing an increase in clients who have pet insurance. And for most pet insurances, they won't cover, just like in humans, used to be in humans, right, pre-existing conditions. But if this is like a trauma, if you got your pet insured when it was a puppy and now it did something, you know, boneheaded out in the yard, you can come to me and your insurance will often pay for us to provide that level of care that you want to have. Mm. Again, it's like we often liken pet insurance to like car insurance. There's a deductible that you pay and then they reimburse a specific amount. Like for example, my pet insurance, which has allowed me to get the advanced care from my very good colleagues for my dog's cancer, right? I pay my deductible for the first part of the care and then I pay 10% of everything that's left. So they pay 90% of my total bill. Mm. And that's allowed me to get the care that I want for my pets because even I can't afford all of the things that are needed to provide my pets with the best quality of life and the best level of medical care that we can provide at MedVet. So.
Yeah. And as a vet, you can't do it all yourself.
I cannot. No. Yeah. And I also hate working on my own animals. There's an emotional component to it that I don't have with my clients. So for me, I like to drop my pets off with my colleagues down the hallway, and they do everything that needs to be done, and I take them home at the end of the day.
And so you mentioned extraction versus root canal. How much, what's the general cost of an extraction versus that root canal procedure you were talking about?
Honestly, it's really not that huge of a difference.
Oh, really?
It's all based on time for me. The way that we charge is based mm-hmm. on how long it takes me to do the surgery. And because I do the same thing all day, every day, right? You get really good at it. So an extraction takes me less time, but it's not as technically skilled, so it doesn't cost as much. But when it comes down to, because the anesthesia is exactly the same, still requires dental radiographs, still requires my very talented technical staff to provide the nursing care, it's really only a few hundred dollars different. So like the quotes go from $3,000 to $4,000 to like $2,500 to $3,500. So
yeah.
It really is, it's only a small amount of savings difference. And so usually when people come to me, they want that root canal. And so we're going to end up doing that procedure.
Mm. Dr. Wells, we've talked on this show in the past about the cost of veterinary care increasing. Dr. Ward was just talking about how specialty care can go up, I think you said 3 or 4% a year. Mm-hmm. I saw a figure that could be wrong, that veterinary care is on average like 8% more expensive than it was last year. That was the whole, you know, whole ball of wax. Are those changes having an impact on the graduates of your veterinary technology program at UC?
I would say probably not specifically. I think we've definitely seen an increase in the pay scale, which is a good thing. Veterinary technology graduates are woefully underpaid. I'll just throw that plug in there. There are clinics around that value their technicians and pay them accordingly. But when you compare them to other allied health professionals with 2 or sometimes 4-year degrees, they are usually making less than half of what those people are making with the same level of experience. So when you compare it to, if we just go to dentistry, for example, to a dental hygienist, often those graduates are making somewhere between $60,000 and $70,000 when they graduate, whereas our students, our graduates, are really fortunate to be able to make, you know, maybe $30,000 to $40,000 when they graduate. So there is a real disparity there. And that is getting better. So for me, you know, as somebody who's advocating for these students, for getting jobs that pay them and utilize them well, I am hoping that we can pay them more, and we do see those numbers come up because we survey our graduates every year, and the market has to support that. It's definitely regional, so there definitely are clinics out there that can't afford to pay their staff that much, and it may be that their pricing structure is different. Maybe their clientele is not going to pay $2,000 for a dental, and so they may have a different scale for their services, but that probably means they're also paying their staff a different scale, mm-hmm. right? And so that may be fine based on where that student lives or that graduate lives. They may be able to afford that, but you know, I'm always advocating for my graduates to make a living wage. And for someone to have a living wage in the state of Ohio, I believe it's close to $30,000 a year. And if you're not making that after graduating from college, I think there's a problem.
Yeah. Well, we do have a caller on the line. Hi, Ginger. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
First of all, I want to thank all the experts for sharing their advice. It's so helpful, so thank you.
Wonderful. We're glad to have them here.
Yeah, I too. Years ago, a friend of mine told me that she couldn't eat her cat and asked me if I could adopt her, and I was able to adopt her, and she was a beautiful lilac point Siamese. So when I got her, she was 4 years old, but she'd never been spayed. So I had her have a wellness exam, and I got her spayed. So then when she was 7 years old, I was giving her a tummy rub, and I felt a lump on a mammary gland, and the lump and mammary gland were removed, and it was mammary cancer. Then that happened twice more, you know, another mammary gland, another lump, and then it was removed. But then after that, she didn't have any anymore, and actually she lived to be 19 years old. So the first thing my question is, other than maybe having them spayed as kittens, are there any other things you can do to prevent mammary cancer in cats? And also, you know, I try my best to give her, you know, good nutritional food, filtered water, you know, not plastic water bowls. But if a cat does get mammary cancer, what are some of the best ways to treat that? And thank you all so much.
Oh, thank you, Ginger. What do you think, Dr. Wells? I'm going to go to you with this. And certainly it sounds like Ginger took great care of that cat to live to be 19 years old. That's fantastic. But yeah. Is there a correlation between getting a cat spayed later in life and mammary cancer?
Yeah. And Emily, you, Dr. Ward, you jump in here. She's like, nope. So there is definitely a link in our animals with hormonal changes. And the more times that an animal goes through heat, the more likely they are as they age to actually develop mammary tumors. And that's the same in dogs and cats. And so that's one of the reasons that we do advocate for our animals to get spayed and neutered earlier. The other one is the big thing that we've already been talking about is our shelter overpopulation problem. But to get back to the question, really the best thing that we can do is get them spayed and neutered. Obviously, talk to your veterinarian to find out what is best for your individual animal. There is some new research out that, you know, some breeds of dogs, for example, which has been the most studied, it might be better to wait, you know, a certain period or certain age for those animals. It may be some other long-term health implications that we can improve if they're not spayed or neutered when they're, you know, 4 to 6 months of age. But regarding mammary cancer and treating it, this owner did the exact right thing, and I'm very happy that the cat did well after surgery. But the best thing to do is obviously keep the animal as healthy as possible, which she indicated that she was able to do, and then we surgically remove those mammary tumors. If my memory serves me correct, and I may be incorrect because I haven't looked this up in a long time, I believe that cat mammary tumors tend to be a little bit more localized and are not as likely to metastasize. So the fact that she found them early and got them removed pretty quickly was probably to this cat's benefit in that they didn't metastasize. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes by the time the owner sees them or can afford doing something about it, they may have metastasized and it can be a little bit poorer outcome.
Mm-hmm. And I would add from the shelter perspective that spay neuter in 2024, that was the number one request for assistance that we received. I think there's a misconception out there that people just don't want to spay or neuter. They do. We're seeing that as a big reason why people are calling and asking for low cost spay neuter. It can get really expensive. I don't know the numbers. Our veterinarians here probably could speak to that a little bit better, but that's obviously another cost prohibitive issue. We're not seeing people surrender their pets because they can't spay or neuter, but we are seeing more animals because mm-hmm. those people can't spay or neuter. So definitely an issue we're seeing in the yeah. shelter
absolutely.
Field.
And I would just piggyback yeah. off of that and say we are very fortunate in the greater Cincinnati area that we do have high quality, high volume spay neuter clinics around that are
yep.
helping these owners that can't afford it get their animals spayed and neutered for a much reduced cost. The downside is there are waiting lists, mm-hmm. right? So as soon as you bring that puppy or kitten home, go ahead and get on the waiting list because yeah. oftentimes it is booked several months out. But these guys are doing, I don't know if the numbers are like 40,000 animals a year or something yeah. astronomical. And I'm always astounded that, you know, OAR and UCAN, that they can do that many spays and neuters every year, and there still are that many animals out there that need to be spayed and neutered. So right. kudos to them for, you know, keeping up as well as they can. They also sometimes run, they have specials that they get funding for. So, you know, maybe it is breed specific. Sometimes it's a dog or a cat thing. And so keep your ears open for those because oftentimes they will, you know, get done for free or they'll throw in free vaccines or heartworm tests or something like that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ginger. We really appreciate your call and we appreciate your listening. We are going to take a quick break and we will continue our pet show after that. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about pets for the full hour today with a panel of experts to answer your questions about your favorite dog or cat. We even have somebody in here who knows about goats and chickens. So we've got a lot of bases covered, yeah. My guests are MedVet Cincinnati veterinary dentist, Dr. Emily Ward, Dog Abilities owner and trainer, Day Groden, Cincinnati Animal Care Shelter Director, Megan Colville, and University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells. Do you have questions for them? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.com. www.nicknickpets.org. We did get a call from Nick. He didn't stay on the line, but he wanted to ask, what should we look out for when it comes to pet insurance to make sure our pet is getting good care and we are getting a good deal? I know we have a number of thoughts on that. Do you want to start, Dr. Ward?
Sure. So I send my clients, I have no affiliation with this website, but I know it's been around a long time, is petinsurancereview.com. Like, I just tell people, Google pet insurance review, and there's a website. And as far as I know, it continues to list all of the plans that are out there. We were discussing over the break how, like, 15 years ago when I graduated from vet school, there was like 4 companies that did this, and now there's hundreds of them, right? And even like sometimes your employer will have like an employer-sponsored pet insurance plan. And typically the way that I saw the website is it will list each plan out and like, does it cover preventive care? Does it cover just emergency? How do you fill out your deductible? Does it base how it pays you back on the market value of that item where you live based on your zip code? Because like a heartworm test here might say, I'm just going to make up some random numbers. These are not real numbers, okay? But in market A, the heartworm test might cost $40, right? Because you live in a big city and there's lots of people and cost of living is higher. But if you live out in the boondocks in market B, that heartworm test might be a $25 test. Mm. So they like, but if your pet has a problem in market A, they still might only cover market B's actual price because that's where you're paying your particular plan's cost, right? So should go through like all of those different things. And you have to take all those things into consideration. This is why I personally just got a blanket fee plan, which probably costs more on a per month basis, but I can get any care I want from any place that I want with any veterinarian that I want. And they just write me a check for that 90%. They have different levels too. Like I have the highest level plan because I can afford it. But I know that like the company that I use has like they'll pay 70% or 80% or 90%, mm-hmm. and you can choose your deductible. Is it $1,000 a year? Is it $250 a year? Is it $500 a year? So each company's going to, they're trying to sell you something. So sure. They will make it very easy for you to know for the most part. And I'm sure that there is a lot of, you just have to be careful to read that fine print so that when you show up at the veterinarian, for example, I had a client the other day, their dog broke 2 of his teeth. Again, here we are back on the root canals.
Yeah.
Broke 2 of his teeth and they wanted to save the dog's teeth. But when they called their insurance plan to see if they would cover it, they wouldn't cover the cost of the root canal, but they would cover the cost of the extraction. So basically it ended up that the insurance company paid us up to the cost of what it would have been for me to extract those teeth and they covered the difference so that they could get the level of care that they wanted to have. So sometimes those kinds of things can be worked out too, but still saves the client a lot of money.
Sure.
Because the difference again was like $500 or something, right? Versus having to pay that whole several $1,000 fee to have that care.
Sounds a lot like human health insurance.
It's becoming more that way, yeah, I think. And for good and for bad, it helps our technicians get paid what they're worth, right? Because we can support some of these increased costs for labor that we have to do the jobs that we need to do. Also there's some downsides to human insurance, at least from a practitioner's point of view. Yeah. We have a whole department in MedVet that deals with the insurance, and they take care of that for our clients. So at least I don't have to be filling out insurance forms yet.
It's complicated. Yeah.
So one other thing about pet insurance that I think people need to consider, too, is really what breed dog you have. Because depending on what breed, there are some breeds that are just more, they have more pre-existing conditions or they can have more health problems just kind of in general. The pet insurance companies definitely look at that. I'll just give a quick example. I have 4 dogs. 2 of them are older, so they definitely like their premiums are higher. But the other 2 who are younger, 4 and 2, the 2-year-old who's a Cavalier is actually the highest per month premium. And that's just because Cavaliers, they can have a number of health issues in general, especially as they do get a little older and things like that. Knock on wood, she's been very healthy. But that is just something, you just have to consider when you're getting pet insurance.
Yeah.
And I would add that you don't necessarily have to insure all of your pets. If you've got more than one or you're worried about the cost, that's something I've done is look at who's most at risk. And those are the 2 that are insured. Everybody else is not right now, and I'm just, prepared. If I need to do something with them, I can, or I hope I can, but I'm just doing the insurance for just a couple of them. One of them is a golden retriever to that point. She is likely in her life to get cancer or some other issue, so I went ahead and got her insured, and that was sort of the decision I made with mostly based on breed.
Yeah.
I'll just add a quick anecdote. I've had a cat have two foreign body surgeries at MedVet. So he's my problem child that needs to have insurance. I've had yet to find out if that is a pre-existing condition where, you know, orange cats, they share one brain cell. And he doesn't get his very often, so he eats things he's not supposed to.
Yeah. Yes, my older daughter has a cat that just, she likes to eat clothing, and it is not, it's been unpleasant for my older daughter, and I'm sure for the cat, but yes. Well, we have a caller on the line. Hey, Lynette, thanks for your call. What's your question?
Oh, yeah, hi. I have three toy breed dogs. They are 5 pounds, and the 5 pound ones are 2 years old, and I have a third who is 5 months old, and I don't know about if I should put them on a feeding schedule or not. And because the girls, the two are older, they're like two, and they're trim and fit and, you know, can jump up on things, so on and so forth. And the younger one, who's 5 months old, is getting quite chubby and eats constantly, and seems like, and he's getting overweight. So I didn't know. I've never had small dogs. I always had extremely large dogs. I wasn't sure about putting small dogs on feeding schedules, if it's recommended or.
Okay. Well, thanks, Lynette. That's a good question. And do you have thoughts on that, Dr. Wells?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for the question. That's a great question. And I think, unfortunately, when you're living in a multi-dog or multi-cat household, sometimes you have to do what's appropriate for one of the animals living in the house, even though the others may not necessarily need that. I do not know of a negative to a feeding schedule to the other two dogs who at this point don't need that, but I do know the negatives for a dog being overweight. And so I think we need to probably tailor the household routine to the dog that needs that care right now. And it is possible that you may need to maybe supplement the food until the other two dogs kind of get with the program. So in other words, if you're feeding maybe 2 to 3 times a day might be appropriate to start, just because the other two dogs, we don't know when they eat. They probably graze all day. And this new dog might just have, you know, a feeding preference where they don't understand that food's going to be there all the time. And so they just scarf it down all the time and they're eating too much. And so maybe what you do is that you feed everybody in their separate little dishes so you know what they're getting, but then you bring up those dishes after they've all eaten or had an opportunity to eat for 5 or 10 minutes. And then it comes back out again in the middle of the day, depending on what your schedule is. And then they get a little snack before bedtime as well. I know with small dogs, you definitely don't want them to go without food for an extended period of time, for sure, because we can get some hypoglycemia and those sorts of problems. So we want to make sure they have access to food. I'm not sure if you feed dry food or canned food, but sometimes that can entice them to go ahead and eat when the food is available because it might be a little bit more palatable. They may dive right in and then, you know, get their full nutritional needs at those meals versus the grazing. So that would be my recommendation.
An alternative as well is they do make microchip feeders and other feeding devices that can be activated with like an RFID tag on a collar. So for they refuse to not be grazers, you can at least program some of these sophisticated feeders that they will open only for certain animals. I had to have one where it not only opened for the one animal, but if the other one that was greedy would come by, it would slam shut, even if the other one was actively eating, to keep
very aggressive
greedy cat out of timid cat's breakfast. But they can be very effective, and they help, especially if you're not home all day to feed multiple meals per day. I've used several different brands of microchip feeders and had some success that way at my own house.
Yeah, my sister has one of those for her two. She has two for her two cats because they have to eat separate different food, and it's a whole thing. But yeah, I've heard that those can be very helpful. Mm-hmm. Well, Lynette, thank you so much. I hope that helps you and your little puppies there. We also have an email from Beth. Beth says, I have a cat who is constantly scratching her fur out and biting her skin. The vet said she doesn't have fleas but could have an allergy. What sort of allergy could be causing this? And, you know, I've read that skin allergies for pets have become a really common medical problem. I see some heads shaking very vigorously in the yes position. So who wants to talk about what kinds of allergies this poor cat might have?
I can start, but I'm sure others have opinions as well. Certainly, I always have to start with flea allergy just because it is so common. And the other thing, when you have a cat who is flea allergic, they are so good at grooming that it is common to not see any fleas. Mm. So even if we don't see fleas, I do want to make sure that the cat is on a quality flea preventative. So I'll just start with that. But I've actually had a couple of my own cats over the years that have had this type of an issue where I knew they were on flea control, they didn't have fleas, and they're just, you know, eating themselves up. And so just like with humans, they can have allergies to things in the air, which we know, depending on the environment they're living in, they can potentially have a greater risk to those types of allergens. But then they also can have food allergy. And those can be, on one hand, they can be difficult to deal with in that you have to do a food trial where you're keeping the cat or dog on a very specific, probably expensive food for an extended period of time. And they can't get anything else, including food and treat, or, you know, treats and things. And if you have other pets in the household, that's obviously, we were just talking about that, that can be a challenge. But I think the easy part is if you do that and the itching goes away, you know what your problem is, right? And so it's not a lot of medications or doing allergy injections and those types of things. So those are usually the big three things, is going to be fleas, inhaled allergy or atopy, we call it, and then the food allergy. And probably food and fleas are going to be the big two that I would be most concerned about. We do have veterinary dermatologists around, and so I would put a plug in if you're getting frustrated or you're not finding your answer. Sometimes probably spending a little bit more, but going to the expert in that area is going to get you an answer faster. So mm-hmm. I would just put a plug in for that.
Yeah. Did you want to add anything, Dr. Ward?
There's a waiting list for veterinary dermatologists right now. We lost our dermatologist at MedVet. Actually, weirdly enough, lives close to my parents in Texas. But anyway, and so now, right now, when I have clients, because actually some dental issues manifest in the mouth, but it's actually a dermatological issue because it's all just skin inside of the mouth. It's just a special type of skin. But basically, if you think you're interested in going to see a veterinary dermatologist, now is the time to call around and get on their waiting list. My clients are waiting like 3 to 6 months right now to get in to see a dermatologist.
Gosh, this is like human dermatologists it also. Is. Yes. Yeah. There are a lot of parallels.
Which doesn't
here.
Mean you can't manage symptoms until right. they get in.
Right? Most definitely,
so
for
your,
sure.
Your yeah. general practitioner, or, you know, your regular vet can help you manage the symptoms.
Okay. Well, we are going to be back after a short break with the last leg of our pet show. See what I did there? If you have questions, now's the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back to wrap up today's pet show. My guests are Dog Abilities owner and trainer, Dave Groden, Cincinnati Animal Care Shelter Director, Megan Colville, University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director, Dr. Jennifer Wells, and MedVet Cincinnati Veterinary Dentist, Dr. Emily Ward. If you've got questions about your favorite furry friend or comments you'd like to share, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from Joseph, who writes, "My mother of 97 years has recently passed and wished to donate her pacemaker to a dog in need. We're finding this more difficult than originally thought. Do you have any information regarding this? Is this practice still used in veterinary medicine?" Any thoughts from our veterinarians?
So I will say I've never heard of this practice. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, because we did find that maybe this is possible.
Yeah, our associate producer checked on the internet and found that this is a fact checked, yes.
Yeah, so I think the consensus among our group when we were positing this question during the break was that the best thing to do would be to contact one of the excellent veterinary cardiologists in the area. So at MedVet, we've got two of them, Dr. Wright and Dr. Shuckman. And then at Care Center, there's Dr. McLean, or Ohio State would be the other place, because the veterinary college is up there, and they would probably have more information about being able to donate this item to do a pacing for a dog, which is a thing that we definitely do, and they're very expensive, so I'm sure someone would benefit greatly from that.
Okay, so just that sounds like you need to do a little legwork, Joseph, make some phone calls, but thanks. It was, I'm sorry about the loss of your mother, but wow, what a tremendous, long, rich life it sounds like she lived. We have a caller on the line. Hi, Chris. Thanks for listening. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I had a quick question. When we take our dogs in to, they get their teeth done, they're under anesthesia, and frequently the veterinarian wants to do a battery of, like, tests, liver function tests and things prior to the anesthesia. I know that in adults, we, like in humans, we've eliminated a lot of preoperative labs, and I'm wondering how data-driven the preoperative labs are, or if they're just an added expense.
That's a great question, Chris, and so medically phrased. I feel like we might have a medical professional on the line. What do you think, Dr. Ward? Is this something that you really insist on? Does the age of the pet make a difference?
So at MedVet, we have a policy that the lab work needs to be done, it has to be recent, within the last 3 months. So like if I have a client who gets blood work on their annual done in January, but they don't make it my way till April, before we anesthetize their animal, we will repeat both a complete blood cell count, or a CBC, and a serum chemistry profile before we will anesthetize that pet. And that's a requirement at our hospital. Other hospitals may have other policies, and I've worked in a lot of places that it was or was not important. I don't know if I have a lot of evidence-based references to provide to say, like, it really makes a big difference in the way that we do certain things. However, I think the biggest thinking in veterinary medicine about why we do some more of these sort of non-invasive preoperative testing versus in human medicine is that a human can come to you with a symptom and they can say something like, wow, I've been drinking a lot more water. I feel really thirsty lately, or my urine is strange, versus an animal who goes out in the yard and you're probably not watching them urinate because you see that they're doing it, but you're not looking at the quality of that bodily substance. And they're not telling you that they're necessarily feeling more thirsty or having other things. And so these biochemical tests do help us to catch alterations and metabolic function that may have otherwise gone unnoticed. And hopefully they're at an earlier stage so we can either modify anesthetic protocols to help support those pets physiologically while they're under anesthesia, blood pressures, hydration status, do we change the drugs that we use because they're metabolized in a different organ throughout the body? Do we need to pay different attention to some of our parameters while we're doing this during the actual procedure? Or do we need to recommend follow-up testing for that animal? And there are definitely multiple occasions while we're doing blood work morning of before a dental procedure where I'm finding something that's not going to stop me necessarily from anesthetizing that pet and performing good routine, you know, periodontal prophylactic care. But I will recommend to the client that they go visit their veterinarian and continue, like, we saw these aberrations. Now follow up with your family veterinarian to get some more testing done, or do we need to see if these values change, or, you know, maybe there's something else that needs to be done down the line to help support this pet's aging process better.
Okay. Well, Chris, I hope that helps. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for your question. We also have Rob on the line, but I can't make Rob come there. It's the new phone system. It's smarter than I am. Okay, here we go. Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for listening. What's your question or comment?
I recently have a cat that about a week old, that had six kittens. Now, and what I'm trying to fit, they're all black, and the mother's black. How do I identify which cat is which? By dyeing their tail, or putting a hole in their ear somewhere, different ways? What would I do to be able to? And to tell which one's which.
Well,
that's my question.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm going to tell on a friend of mine who had two identical human babies, and she wrote their initials on the bottom of their feet. But I think that would be harder to do with pets. Megan, you get to answer this. When do you all? How do you all tell them apart when you've got a litter of kittens? That
we get a lot of litters that all look the same.
Yeah.
Especially a lot of black litter. Like they're all black, and they're. For some reason, that seems to be a group that is pretty consistent. The method that we'll use is to maybe get a Sharpie or something that is, you know, a marker or some type, and just kind of draw a different color inside the ear. And that'll help you mark, you know, who's who. So if you can get different colors of those, just
like
a small little dot.
Eventually
it'll go away. But just a little color dot and write that down, who's who.
Yeah.
So you have a little key to... be able to go back to and make sure and understand who's who. This becomes especially important if you are getting them vaccinated or they're getting different medical care as they get a bit older.
Yeah.
So you can keep track of that.
Well, that's it's like a little temporary tattoo.
Yeah.
So that's a great advice.
We've had people put maybe like a scrunchie or something around the neck. We don't typically recommend that just due to it could get a little bit tight. And if the kittens are getting bigger, it could cause problems. So the color in the ear seems to be the best way to keep the kittens safe as they grow.
And I bet they could get those scrunchies off, some of them.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Rob. Thanks so much for that excellent question. We have a question from David who asks, we have a Labradoodle that had surgery recently and we had to hand feed her. Now that she's better, she won't eat from her bowl. She is being fed canned food, which makes it hard to just leave it out for whenever she might eat. I'm going to come to you for this one, Dave. This sounds like a behavior issue.
Yeah, sometimes that can definitely be tough when the dog has had like a different food that they might find a little more valuable than their normal kibble. I always say in general they should put the dog on a feeding schedule. That will definitely help just because it starts to build value. So meaning that you might set their dish of food down for, I don't know, 10 minutes, something like that. And if they don't eat it, I just take it away. I put it on the counter, put it in the fridge, something like that. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to go till the next meal to feed them. Some people definitely do that and the dogs figure it out. And they're kind of like, well, this is what I'm getting. This is what I need to eat. But I look at it as like you can always re-present the food. But the idea is that the dog is eating the food when you are presenting it. Because again, it builds more value to the food. Mm-hmm. That is probably the biggest thing that I see with people who will tell me, well, my dog's not really very food driven, or they don't want to eat their food. They just eat the treats, kind of that type of thing. I think dogs kind of like people, you know, they will sometimes eat the better food or what they think of as better food than what they might normally need, you know, the kibble or whatever they're being fed. Mm-hmm. So I look at too as dogs who are healthy, they're really not going to starve themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, most of them will eventually eat. Sometimes it is a little bit. You got to just kind of tough it out a little bit.
A little tough love there.
But they do. Most of them do come around and they will get back to eating their regular food. But you do have to watch with adding too many toppers and trying to make it too enticing. I think if you just value or if you look at eating itself as just a behavior, mm-hmm. that tends to, you know, kind of change how you think about it and will help your dog.
Have you run into this thing with hand feeding? I mean, that's like a whole different ball. I mean, I'm a cat person, but I've had picky cats who decide they like something, don't like something, but I've never had to hand feed one. I don't know how that would, do some dogs just think I'm a princess? Like, this is how I eat now?
There's definitely been some dogs who do that. Again, I'm kind of, you know, maybe I'm a little bit old school and kind of like, you got to put the food down, you got to eat it in a sense. Now, I mean, I think we as pet parents and things like that certainly make exceptions. You know, if a dog is ill, cat is ill, something like that, we do want to help them. When I have my bunny, you know, and she broke her jaw.
Aww.
So I did have to syringe feed her.
Yeah.
You know? And I did that for, I don't know, I think it was a couple weeks or something. And then finally she ate, you know, on her own again. So so you do have to watch doing that and, so that your dog just learns that here's the food and you can eat on your own. I mean, sometimes we might have to think about what we're doing. Maybe we have to sit close to them at first and then gradually move away. You know, I mean, change location maybe. There's lots of different things.
Yeah. So this is my own personal question. One of my picky eaters is an old man cat, and when he doesn't eat all his wet food, I'll add a little water and kind of stir it up to make it seem to revive it a little bit. Is that okay? Am I doing it okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, those old picky cats are a whole different story, and it's often not behavioral. It's it's probably related to, you know, metabolic changes that they're going through.
Yeah.
Sometimes even using warm water can help with the flavoring or the smell.
Yeah.
And kind of entice them a little bit as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. I'm glad I'm not messing something up there because I've just been doing it. I've just gone rogue.
Yeah. They probably need more water anyway, so that will help.
Well, okay. Speaking of food, I saw a New York Times article about an effort to make pet food and treats using either insects or lab-grown meat. This is billed as kind of a sustainability thing. What do you all think? I mean, I feel like a lot of dogs and cats eat bugs anyway, but I don't know about that being their only diet? Does anybody have thought? I mean, would you feed your pets bug food?
I don't think I would feed them like strictly bug food. That's just not my thing. But I have given my dogs treats that were like whatever cricket based or something like that. And I will say they didn't know any difference. Yeah. They were like, I'll eat this, no problem.
Yeah. I feel like the cats might be the tougher customers. That maybe that's just me as a cat person. What about you? You've got chickens, Megan. They're eating bugs and stuff all the time, I bet.
Would
you? Yeah.
Yeah. The chickens and goats are outside all the time eating bugs. I've got cats and dogs that chase bugs. So maybe they'd like it. My concern as a pet owner would just be looking at the nutritional value and making sure that it's something that is good for them and then also something that they're able to digest well and seem healthy on.
Yeah.
Given the number of pets we see that eat too many cicadas whenever we have those like big blooms, like you think like why crickets? We should definitely do like a cicada based food. Like that seems to be the favorite of a lot of dogs around this area.
Wouldn't that be sad if you're a cicada? You've been underground for 17 years
and now
you come
food.
Out and like surprise your dog food. Yeah. That's a bummer. What do you think, Dr. Wells? What about lab-grown meat? Is that something you think might
work? I read the article ahead of time, and I was trying to remember. I think I've seen something like on 2020 or Dateline or something like that about, this actually being a human product as well. And so I think that's, probably just a natural after effect of that. And again, sustainability and, less cows providing meat. And obviously, I don't know that you would call it vegetarian, but it's definitely a different nutritional source. I definitely agree with what Megan said is that, animals survive off of nutrients and not necessarily ingredients. And I know a lot of pet food companies are very, they definitely promote their ingredients, right? You want to have your chicken as the number one ingredient and not chicken meal or bone meal or whatever. But truly, their bodies thrive off of the nutrients. How much protein is in it and is it a high quality protein, for example. And so, I'm not sure what the nutrient quality is with these, but I know that people in other countries do eat insects, right? When you go to, India or Africa and those sorts of things, they may be even a gourmet delicacy food item. I haven't tried them myself, but I think they might, they might be onto something there. But I just, again, I don't have experience with it. I haven't looked at this particular diet to see if it's quality. And again, seeing what the outcomes are. For me personally, I always want to see a food that's gone through a feeding trial with the animals just so that some group of animals has eaten this diet over a period of time and they have done well. It's just not a nutrient profile. So, yeah.
Well, and for me as a cat person, I always wonder what my litter box is going to look like when you change up the food. That's a big thing. Okay. Well, I have been talking with Cincinnati Animal Care Shelter Director Megan Colville, University of Cincinnati Blue Ash College Veterinary Technology Program Director Dr. Jennifer Wells, MedVet Cincinnati Veterinary Dentist Dr. Emily Ward, and Dog Abilities Owner and Trainer Dave Groden. Thank you all so much for your time today. It's been a great show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. And if you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.